When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Here I know.
The Agora Podcast Network. Agora is a marketplace of the mind, where intelligent, independent podcasts meet curious and discerning listeners. Our network of shows includes
American Biography,
The Bohemian Podcast,
How Jamaica Conquered the World,
The History of the Papacy,
The History of England,
The History of Alchemy Podcast,
Mid-Atlantic,
When Diplomacy Fails,
1001 Conversations,
History of Anglo-Saxon England,
The Secret Cabinet from Germany,
10 American Presidents,
The History of Germany Podcast,
The Agora Podcast Network.com. Listen to Agora today.
Before we start the show, I'd just like to remind you all that Roundtable Talk is part of the Agora Podcast Network. The Agora Podcast Network is a network of independently crafted podcasts from some of the best podcasters from around the world. This month, we are featuring the excellent History of China podcast by Chris Stewart. I recommend you go to iTunes, Acast, or your favourite podcaster of choice today to go and download this excellent series. Hello and welcome to a rather special impromptu Agora podcast show. I'm Royfield Brown from the podcast 10 American Presidents, and I'm joined by Ben Jacobs from the podcast Wittenberg to Westphalia, who has a BA in International Relations, and my old friend, or the old mucker as we say in England, Travis Dow from the History of Germany and Bohemian podcast, who's not only lived in Germany for 10 years, but also lived in the Czech Republic for 10 years. So he's had 20 years on the European mainland. Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
Doing all right.
Hello.
Right, now, there's been somewhat of an earthquake geopolitically. With the UK's historic vote to Brexit, the post-war European status quo that started in 1945 is all but over. We are here to discuss its ramifications. Ben, I'm going to come to you first because you've got the big brain when it comes to international relations, and I know you're a bit of a lover of all things EU. Give us, for our US listeners, a very brief overview of the European project that is the EU.
Very, very quickly, because I could talk about this for hours, and I've managed to condense it down to a page of notes. To understand the foundation of the EU, we actually have to go back to 1918. And at that time, the Allied governments owed the U.S. a huge amount of money for all the supplies they had bought during the war. The Allies, in turn, were owed a huge war indemnity from Germany under the Treaty of Versailles. And the U.S., in turn, loaned Germany the money to help them rebuild and pay off the debts. Right? All through the 20s, this worked out pretty good. And the U.S. was making money hand over fist, but when the Depression started, countries started erecting tariff barriers to protect their internal businesses from foreign competition. So the U.S., the U.K., Germany, and Japan all had these networks of sweetheart deals, so they thought they could survive. But really what ended up happening was that it shut down international trade, except in these very specific colonial empires or networks of puppet states or what have you. The U.S. actually kind of started it with the Smoot-Hardley Act, but the U.K. replied in kind by raising a tariff barrier on American goods. So did France, and things went back and forth. And there was this sort of undeclared economic war through the early 30s that people don't really talk about these days, but which had a pretty big hand in extending the Depression. So if we fast forward to World War II, people are looking back on this and going, well, that was a mistake. Economic issues are clearly a big part of what caused World War II. And so as early as 1942, the U.S. and its allies had begun to plan for what would happen in the post-war order, and economic issues were a very strong part of that. By 1945, it was clear that the opinions of the U.S. and Russia mattered more than everyone else. And the U.S. had a number of competing policy ideas that they had been developing over the course of the war, which they wanted to see fleshed out in the post-war economic order. But then the Cold War happened. No one really saw that coming. So there was sort of a multi-level post-war order that developed. And the first level was this containment order, where everyone was keeping communism contained. And that was not planned. It was very haphazard and sort of was thrown together on the fly. On the other hand, the order that was established in the West, between Western countries, that was very planned. It was very dear to the heart of American and Allied planners, and was something they had a lot of skin in the game on. But it was also mostly economic, and so it's not the kind of thing that gets talked about a lot in podcasts and history shows and stuff. An international relations expert called John Eikenberry calls this the layer cake approach, where these various different policy ideas that had been developed in the U.S. were sort of all put together into a very stratified thing. So depending on how you look at it, the top layer could be the Marshall Plan, which was set up to stabilize the European economic system. But the Marshall Plan money was administered through an organization of European leaders that the U.S. insisted be set up so that it's not like the U.S. is just dumping money on people. And that was the Organization for European Economic Cooperation, the OEEC, which continues today as the International Aid Organization, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the the OECD.
There you go. Yeah.
On the flip side, the Europeans had one overriding fear in 1945, and it wasn't the communists. They were very afraid that the U.S. would say, all right, job well done, and go home, and leave, you know, a burned out, burned over France, Italy, and Britain to try and take care of Germany and make sure that Germany didn't become a threat again. And this became worse once the Marshall Plan was announced, because, you know, the U.S. was rebuilding Germany too. And so, you know, we're looking at this nightmare scenario where everybody's all getting U.S. aid. They're all rebuilding. We could be back in 1939 in no time flat. So the Europeans pushed really hard for the U.S. to get itself involved in international organizations like the U.N. and particularly NATO, which was famously founded for the purpose of keeping the Russians out, the Germans down, and the U.S. in. I don't want to go into all the aspects of the layer cake because obviously it's really complex. The crowning achievement was probably the Bretton Woods Agreement, which managed the international economy until the 1980s.
Isn't that where you Americans tricked us out of our global hegemony in terms of the pound?
Well, actually, all of this is kind of tricking the British because, you know, free trade was clearly a huge aspect of this whole arrangement. And despite protestations to the contrary during the height of the empire, the British didn't really like free trade as much as they maybe said they did. they wanted to have the freest trade of all the free trades. You know, they had their empire, and within the empire and then in the Commonwealth, there were supposed to be a bunch of sweetheart deals, and everyone was coordinated as a part of this sort of semi-free trade or freer trade system. But that free trade didn't apply to everyone else. You know, if you were French, you couldn't come into the trade with a Commonwealth country as if you were England. So a lot of what the U.S. was doing with this post-war settlement, a lot of it follows very strongly on the 14 points, because Roosevelt was a fan of Wilson. So a lot of it was, but now the U.S. isn't, you know, some Johnny Come Lately powered. Now the U.S. is like, the U.S. in 1945 had 50% of the world's economic output. So the U.S. walks into the situation and says, I know you want your colonial empires back, but come on, guys. That's not going to happen anymore. So a lot of this was robbing England of its former preeminence. You know, England was no longer the preeminent world power. And everyone knew that, but the U.S. made sure that a lot of, you know, Churchill and a lot of British politicians were hoping that they'd have something left, some sort of post-colonial economic advantages, and the U.S. sort of made sure that that wasn't the case. And there's the Commonwealth is still there, and there's still economic advantages to that, but the U.S. made them much less advantageous than they could have been.
All right. So take us from Bretton Woods to the formation of the steel and coal union.
World interest focuses on the Quai d'Orsay as six European nations, including Western Germany, meet for their first working session on the Schuman plan for pooling steel and coal. Monsieur Schuman's immediate aim is to thin out economic boundaries between nations, and the latest plan for overall control of the project by an international assembly of MPs may well herald the dawn of a brighter future. Sponsors of the idea think this will be so, in particular, Jean Monnet. But Britain, notable absentee, has not yet made up her mind. Her absence begs the question, can the Schuman plan possibly succeed?
This all clearly wasn't just an American hobby horse that was being beaten. There were a lot of European leaders who were very into having an organized European Union of some kind. Churchill actually called in 1948 for a United States of Europe. There were a lot of people talking along those lines in some capacity. In 1951, the European Coal and Steel Community was formed, and that was it coordinated and managed coal and steel production in the Low Countries, so Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg, then France and West Germany. And it was just targeted at coal and steel. And that may not sound like a big deal, but behind the economic aspects were very, very clear political military goals, because in 1945 you couldn't go to war without coal and steel. You needed coal to make electricity, to make the steel, which you used to build tanks and planes and guns and all that stuff. And the goal was to go back to that dream of 1914 and make it economically impossible for European countries to attack each other long term. This was followed up by the Benelux political union between the Low Countries in 1955. And that's, so the Coal and Steel Union was 1951, the Benelux Union's 1955. Things are starting to happen really fast. And the Benelux Union sort of set the political template for the Treaty of Rome, whereas the European Coal and Steel Community was sort of the economic template. The Treaty of Rome happened in 1957, so 2 years later, and that established the European Economic Community, which was mainly a customs union, but with a regional atomic energy management aspect as well. And then since Rome, there have been renegotiations and additions, both geographically and in terms of scope, that happened sort of every couple of years ever since then. Things get really complicated in the 1980s. There were as many as 8 treaty-like regimes going on simultaneously, organizing all sorts of different aspects of the European economy and political activity. And this isn't even to start talking about NATO and other international or treaties like that. In 1992, the Maastricht Treaty sort of simplified things rather significantly and created the EU proper, more or less as we know it today. Although it was renegotiated again in the Lisbon Treaty in 2007. So that's the very, very fast bullet pointed history of the EU. And just to sort of reflect on the implications of a bit of what I just said. Oh, and I should say what the EU is now. Right at this moment in time before the Brexit goes through and everything else. As it stands right now, there's 28 member states with a number of affiliated states and states seeking admission. The EU operates, it's a hybrid system of supranational and intergovernmental decision-making. So there's international governing bodies, and then there's bodies that are made up of diplomats. And there's seven of these bodies. So there's the European Council, the Council of the European Union, the European Parliament, the European Commission, the European Court of Justice, the Court of Justice of the European Union, and the European Central Bank, and the European Court of Auditors. Several of these bodies are actually democratically elected supranational bodies. So you actually cast a vote and your representative goes out to the European Parliament or whatever. And several of them are not elected. So diplomats or banking officials or whatever make up the staff. So that's the EU as it is right now.
Oh, sorry, you've got more.
No, go ahead.
No, and that, what I was going to say is that what you haven't quite touched on is the way enlargement has actually happened. So as you kind of rightly said, is this starts off with West Germany, France, and the Low Countries and Italy terms of the common market. And then throughout the 1960s, Britain goes through a process of thinking, well, this is nothing to do with us. We shouldn't join. But then by the end of the 1960s, Britain does want to join, applies to join, and actually General de Gaulle says no. By 1973, Britain does join along with Denmark. And then you have in the period of the 70s and the 80s, other Western European countries that join. So Spain joins with Portugal, with Greece, and the EU is kind of somewhat stable until the fall of the communist ex-communist bloc. So then you have a wave of accession, which previous to that you do have Austria and Sweden join, but then you do have this wave of ex-communist countries, so your Polands, your Czech Republics, etc. join. And then what has probably led to Brexit actually is not only Poland joining and the free movement of labour, but then Romania, Bulgaria, etc., let alone other smaller ex-communist countries, which kind of then join afterwards. So we've gone from this core of six countries initially to some 28 now.
Yeah, and those six countries, while they're not, I mean, they all speak different languages and everything, they have sort of an interestingly shared culture and particularly a recent historical experience. Whereas the Eastern European countries are bringing a very different recent history to the party.
And it has to be said that Britain, for kind of geostrategic reasons, wanted there to be a quick accession of countries like Poland, because it saw it as a way of weakening this drive for ever greater political union. You know, the British government was so pro that first wave of Eastern European ex-communist countries to join, because it saw that the Western club of countries could successfully unite politically because of a shared political culture and that shared history of war and trying to avoid that. Whereas the experience of, let's say, the Czech Republic or Slovakia is going to be somewhat different because they've had 30, 40 years of communism, which kind of dislocates them from a Western European perspective, let alone geography.
They're less worried about continual fights with their neighbors and more worried about giant supranational political entities that are oppressing them, maybe.
Just let the fun numbers realize what damage this will do to the European idea.
Well, I'm sure they do. That's why they support it.
Surely the Foreign Office is pro-Europe, isn't it?
Yes and no. If you'll forgive the expression. The Foreign Office is pro-Europe because it is really anti-Europe. The civil service was united in its desire to make sure that the common market didn't work. That's why we went into it.
What are you talking about?
Minister, Britain has had the same foreign policy objective for at least the last 500 years. To create a disunited Europe. In that cause, we have fought with the Dutch against the Spanish, with the Germans against the French, with the French and Italians against the Germans, and with the French against the Germans and Italians. Divide and rule, you see. Why should we change now, when it's worked so well?
That's all. Ancient history, surely.
Yes, and current policy. We had to break the whole thing up, so we had to get inside. We tried to break it up from the outside, but that wouldn't work. Now that we're inside, we can make a complete pig's breakfast of the whole thing. Set the Germans against the French against the Italians against the Dutch. The Foreign Office is terribly pleased. It's just like old times.
Surely we're all committed to the European ideal.
Really, Minister?
If not, why are we pressing for an increase in the membership?
Well, for the same reason. It's just like the United Nations, in fact. The more members it has, the more arguments it can stir up, the more futile and impotent it becomes.
What appalling cynicism.
Yes. We call it diplomacy, Minister.
Okay. So, I did ask you, Ben, to give us your opinion on what exactly has happened in the last week. But I'm going to now throw it over to you, Travis. You've spent time in... you grew up in Bavaria... And then you spent 10 years of your working life in Prague, in the Czech Republic. So your American accent would belie the fact that basically you're a good European, really, aren't you? So give us your perspective. When you heard that 52% of Britons had voted to leave the EU, what was your perspective as somebody who understands the German and Czech psyche?
Yeah, so this is weird because first I thought it was going to be like a close call, like the Scotland getting their independence referendum, where, you know it's a bad idea, you know, so you're kind of like, well, maybe, you know, it'll have a significant minority for the vote for historical reasons or this or that or just, you know, the rhetoric, but it's not going to go through because it's obviously a bad idea. But then it did go through. And I mean, trying to think like how did I even, you know, misunderstand the situation, you know, that badly. And I think part of it is that it's not even a European thing. It seems like in the States, it's just as much true that just nationalism is on the rise everywhere. And that's kind of crazy. Like actually like what's happening in Germany, what's happening in Czech Republic. That's just the last 10 years really is nuts. It's insane. It's something I hoped I'd never have to see and live through.
Yeah.
But now, you know, in parallel, we have the elections here in the States, and we're seeing a similar, like, ugly face of, you know, the population as a whole. And so that, I mean, all those thoughts kind of went through my head when the results kind of came through. But yeah, I'm still kind of in shock, you know, because I like to talk about history topics where in 10 years from now, I could look back and say, you see how bad of an idea that was. You had another major depression, you know, this and that happened, and you see how bad that was, you know. But now it's like it's almost too fresh. Like I kind of I just want to, you know, kind of want to see what happens with a side of like Schadenfreude. I don't know. There's no English word for that, right? Like, it's just, you know, to look upon others.
Oh, we've now adopted that word as being English.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, you just watch their stumblings and kind of smile and like shake your head. You know, unfortunately, that's kind of how I want to feel about like Trump, for instance. But I live here now and I can't. But I saw that when I lived in the Czech Republic. I just moved away a year and a half ago. And I saw that there too, like a rise of nationalism. And even like my friends and colleagues that, you know, be talking over beers. And I was kind of like, you know, I'm talking to you in a foreign language. Like, my Czech is horrible. And like, I'm talking to you in a foreign language. And I, you know, I came here illegally and you know, took a Czech person's job, no doubt, like, for sure. Like, that definitely happened. I took several of them, in fact. And yet, like, you're treating me like I'm not, you know, like I'm somebody else. Like, I don't know, you know, like, but the rise of nationalism was noticeable everywhere. Like, in Germany it is. And that's just like, wow, I just never would have thought. Growing up there, I would have said it's the most just, you know, anti-Semitic country. They just won't tolerate that kind of hate anymore.
Just to clarify, that's anti-Semitic.
Yes.
Yeah, anti-Semitic. That wasn't a stutter. It was like,
yeah.
They're pro, not pro-Jewish, but they won't tolerate anti-Semitism. You know, that's the Germany that I knew growing up. And that Germany has changed. Like, now if you look at the parties, the rightist parties, like, they're at getting, oh, I don't even know the very current numbers, but 10, 15, 20% of the vote, which is like astounding to me. Just like, what is happening? And you know, you just see it in the news, you see it in the streets.
Travis, but yeah, there definitely is a movement throughout Europe, throughout the West, for more nativist politics. There is. Okay, but I think it's interesting, though, that, let's say, the Freedom Party in Germany, or Jean-Marie Le Pen's, not Jean-Marie Le Pen's, now it's his daughter's party, isn't it? But Le Pen's National Front in France. Oh, yeah. They're not nationalist in the strict 1930 sense, which is purely country first. What they also say is, countries like us are fine. So, and I think that kind of gets to the, so the French,
but I mean, quite Poland and Hungary is also going through similar movements. And I mean, yeah, I get, it's just, yeah, no, I know what you're saying. Actually, I was going to ask you, I was going to turn that around and be like, okay, so what is the British version of what were the Brexit's main arguments? And I know how we see them. Right. I look at that and like, whoa, wow. I didn't know England was that racist, frankly.
Okay.
Put it bluntly. But that's not how they ran. They didn't say, hey, get the, you know, what were their other arguments, their other economic arguments for actually that won the vote? I mean, how did, you know, what were they saying?
So Ben gave us a masterful, sweeping historical narrative of the European Union. Britain, very obviously, for reasons of geography and history, has a very different perspective on European integration than, let's say, the French or the Germans. And you've got to, and I think it's one of the crowning glories of the European Union, that people have forgotten that one of its main reasons for existing was to prevent war. Because you look at, here we are in 2016, and it is inconceivable that Germany would attack Poland or that France would invade Germany, etc., etc. And that is in large part, that is, you know, down to the success of economic integration. And so, in a way, the EU has been a victim of its own success. That Brits can just think, oh, this is just all about selling stuff and Poles walking into the country. Yes, that is in large part what the EU is about, but it's not the only thing. It's to safeguard us from war, you know. So the Germans and the French, they understand this much more viscerally than the Brits, because viewed from 1945, they had had 80 years of fighting each other, three wars. Which had laid waste to, in effect, to the western half of the whole continent periodically. So the Brits, we didn't have that experience. Though we went to war in two of those three wars, we didn't have that experience.
Yeah, so it's not as acute. It's not.
And then you have a situation whereby Yes, we had this empire, blah, 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 blah. Your average Brit has no conception as to how broke the country was after the end of the Second World War, that Britain was technically and actually bankrupt. We have no understanding. And
one-fifth the economic output of the United States.
Yeah. You know, we've gone from in 1914 from having an economic output which was at least the same, if you take the empire and whatever, as the United States. And I think we were ahead still by 1914, though the United States is growing rapidly. And then, what, some 20-odd years later, we are, you know, at best a proportion of that. So that's how far we rapidly fall. And us Brits don't really kind of get that. And we don't get how far we fell economically. We don't get the emotional pull of the EU in terms of bulwark against war.
The US has that same problem, maybe even amplified.
Well, and so you should, because you've got a massive ocean, you know, between you.
Yeah.
Right? So we don't get that. But then by the late 1960s, the British economy, though still growing, isn't growing as fast as the West German and the French. So we get passed by Germany, I don't know exactly when, but let's say the late 1960s, early 1970s. And Britain is seen in the 1970s as the sick man of Western Europe economically. We go for, and this is very kind of post-colonial, so we don't have an empire anymore, and we say to ourselves, what the hell is the point of the United Kingdom? You know what, we cannot be getting New Zealand butter anymore or lamb from Australia, etc. We need to trade with the countries closer to us and have ever greater union. And that was a massive psychological shift, but it was sold to us completely as a common market, which is what the EU was called back
right.
then. This is going to give us a free trade space area with our neighbours, of which we have emerging markets with. Look how well the Germans are doing. Look at all these shiny BMWs. We need to compete. We need to be in this marketplace. So we go into this with in 1973, now we have a referendum in 1975, where the British public is asked to underline the decision the government has made. And we go in. But we go in saying we're not interested in ever greater union, which wasn't really on the cards back then. But we went in going, we're keeping a wary eye on this. We are Great Britain after all.
Well, the vote on whether to stay or leave the European community is just 2 days away now, and our guest in Newsday tonight is the leader of the Conservative Party, Mrs. Margaret Thatcher. Mrs. Thatcher, I think there seems to be a feeling that because you've made only one major speech or so about the European question, and that you've therefore left it largely to others to arouse a feeling of deep commitment over Europe, that you're perhaps a lukewarm European yourself.
Not in the least. I hope that showed from the way in which we took the debate in the House of Commons right at the beginning. And then, of course, I did launch the Conservative effort for staying in Europe and then did another European speech. My speeches on Europe have mainly been on my tours about the country as leader of the opposition, when I've dealt usually with three things. First, the economy. Secondly, Europe, and thirdly, whatever was the major topic of the day.
Back then, the currency wasn't an issue.
No.
Which is interesting.
Yeah. No.
So now it's kind of with an understanding that if you join, that's step one. Step two is you'll eventually get our currency.
Mm.
And Britain resisted that. They were like, whoa, no, we never agreed to that.
Yeah, no. And we have never signed up to, though Churchill might have talked about the United States of Europe,
yeah,
post the Second World War, that never had any truck politically in the UK. And it definitely didn't when the chips were down, and we're talking about the 1970s when we actually joined. We have joined this free association of states who can trade together, knock together some laws which basically agree, you know, what is a potato, what is orange juice. So if we're going to sell it, we're all selling the same thing to our markets. That's fundamentally what we've signed up to. And we are, and that's it. But then the problem comes whereby in the late 80s, we sign up to the exchange rate mechanism, which is a way of every European country still has its own currency back then. But it's a way that which basically regulates the movement of these currencies. And by the early 1990s, the exchange rate mechanism kind of falls down and we exit from that. And that's the closest we've come to surrendering the pound.
Mr. Chairman, you have invited me to speak on the subject of Britain and Europe. Perhaps I should congratulate you on your courage. If you believe some of the things said and written about my views on Europe, it must seem rather like inviting Genghis Khan to speak on the virtues of peaceful coexistence. Our links to the rest of Europe, the continent of Europe, have been the dominant factor in our history. But we know that without the European legacy of political ideas, we could not have achieved as much as we did. From classical and medieval thought, we have borrowed that concept of the rule of law, which marks out a civilized society from barbarism. The European community is one manifestation of that European identity, but it is not the only one. We must never forget that east of the Iron Curtain, peoples who once enjoyed a full share of European culture, freedom, and identity have been cut off from their roots. We shall always look on Warsaw, Prague, and Budapest as great European cities. Nor should we forget that European values have helped to make the United States of America into the valiant defender of freedom which she has become. The European community belongs to all its members. It must reflect the traditions and aspirations of all its members. And let me be quite clear. Britain does not dream of some cozy, isolated existence on the fringes of the European community. Our destiny is in Europe as part of the community. That is not to say that our future lies only in Europe, but nor does that of France or Spain, or indeed of any other member. The community is not an end in itself, nor is it an institutional device to be constantly modified according to the dictates of some abstract intellectual concept. Nor must it be ossified by endless regulation. Willing and active cooperation between independent sovereign states is the best way to build a successful European community. To try to suppress nationhood and concentrate power at the center of a European conglomerate would be highly damaging and would jeopardize the objectives we seek to achieve. Europe will be stronger precisely because it has France as France, Spain as Spain, Britain as Britain, each with its own customs, traditions, and identity. It would be folly to try to fit them into some sort of identikit European personality.
So you have the situation whereby in the 90s, it is British government policy to very clearly say, look, these Germans, these French, these Italians, they're up to something here. They want a United States of Europe. We don't want that. However, there are benefits to being part of the EU. We have the Schengen area. We have a free movement of workers. That's quite nice. It means we can nip to France without showing our passport, etc. We can, you know, we can have nice holidays in Greece, and there's no visas, etc. So we say, let's get Poland in, let's get the Czech Republic, let's get in all these countries as quickly as possible, because it will weaken the original core of the EU. deliberate British policy. Mm-hmm. However,
it's
completely a geopolitical and economic counterweight. And there was some talk back in the early 2000s that because the beating heart of the European Union is Germany and is the relationship between Germany and France. It's Germany economically, but politically, France is as important, if not economically, because that is the union. That's what the whole thing is all about.
That's mirrored again in the currency. Yes. That when the currency happened, it was like those were the countries propping it up and like guaranteeing it and you know, that kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. This, and Britain has never been part of that. And there was a talk in the early 2000s that what Britain could be the de facto leader of is the slightly less associated states, or the other states. So Britain and Poland could form a little bit of an axis to counterbalance Germany and France, etc. But we don't have the political will in this country, really, to massively engage with the EU in that way. So that kind of fell by the wayside. But Poland is very significant in all of this. And that is the reason why we've led to a situation whereby this vote happened. So when Poland joined the EU, potentially this meant that, and I think the population of Poland is about 35 million. This meant that in theory, 35 million Poles, just to use Poland as an example, because other countries came in at the same time as Poland, an economy which was at best had 2/3 of the GDP of Western Europe. It meant that 35 million Poles had freedom of movement anywhere within the EU. Now, the Germans were somewhat worried about this. So that's the next, you know, Western European country along. So Germany said, we're going to put a moratorium on total free movement of Poles straight away. Yeah. And I think Germany said it was 5 years. I forget exactly the figure, but the Germans said no. This isn't going to happen. And so did the French, and so did just about everybody else. Significantly, the British said, nah, it's fine. Tony Blair took the risk and said, no, it's fine. And the Labour government, I think, estimated that something like 35,000 Poles a year would move. Now, in the 10-plus years of this open-door policy to Poland, there are now 1 million Poles within the UK. It cannot be overemphasized, gentlemen, the seismic and cultural shock this has had on the average British high street, or main street, as you Americans would say.
Polish is now the second language in the UK. Will we need to revise this to Bulgarian or Romanian next year?
Yes, this figure came out that nearly 500,000 people in England, in Britain, I should say, now speak Polish, and the number of people learning French and German is falling. The number of people learning Polish is going up. Alan Johnson, how do you interpret this? And obviously the question's about Bulgarian and Romanian immigration next year.
Poland's a much bigger country, and I think I've got lots of Polish friends. There has to be a second language. I think Welsh is actually, if you take England and Wales, and Poland comes first. And anyone could speak, comes second. Anyone could speak Polish deserves my full admiration, because it's a very difficult language to speak. Will this happen with Romania and Bulgaria? And this is the issue, I think, about January 2014. You know, if I was the EU Commission, I would seek to find a way to put that decision back by 4 or 5 years. And I tell you why. It's not about an issue of being anti-immigrant. My concern is that if they lift that restriction, then Romania will lose a lot of, and Bulgaria will lose a lot of their finest talent. I would like to see in the European Union some kind of GDP measure that says once you've reached that GDP measure, once your country is at a certain level of prosperity, that's when free movement kicks in. Because if you do that, you can ensure that countries coming into the European Union, who by definition are usually much poorer and take time, that's why there's 7 years, one of the reasons why there's 7 years is there, that there's actually a chance to extend that for the sake of that country as well. I think in terms of what happened with the Polish population coming here, history's being rewritten. In 2004-05, I was a minister at the time. We had a highest rate of employment ever known in this country, and we had 600,000 vacancies. The reason why us, Sweden and Ireland all lifted that restriction early is because our economy and our employers told us it was necessary to do that. Yes, it's right, more people came than was expected. That won't happen.
Ed Miliband said it was a mistake. You don't think it was a mistake?
That won't happen this time.
Do you think it was a mistake or not?
I don't think, I disagree with Ed in terms of... I think in hindsight, you would have a better grasp of the numbers. If you knew that many number was coming, then you'd look at it again.
All right. Dom Jolly, we have to be rather swift here because we're coming towards the end.
I mean, I sort of get what this question is basically about, is, you know, are we going to allow people to come into this country? And people, there seems to be a... There was something sort of a bit pernicious about saying, oh, Polish is suddenly the second biggest language. I mean, I have a problem, I think, with sort of ghettoisation, if people come in and don't learn English and kind of don't assimilate. But to me, Polish is, I mean, A, the most complicated language in the world, so anyone can speak it, fantastic. But I think most Poles speak English anyway, so I don't see it as a particular problem. I hope there will be possibly slightly more control on Romanian and Bulgarian coming in, because I think people... I have no problem people coming in who are actually going to work, but I think if people are coming in supposedly to sponge off us or whatever...
This was pointed out to me, I got to say, this was pointed out to me by a taxi driver in Edinburgh last time I was in Scotland. He was like, oh, yeah, when I grew up in this neighbourhood, it was... Oh, and I was just like, oh, my God. Like, do you not realise that you're talking to a foreigner? But he was complaining. I mean, he was like, I don't remember exactly what he said, but this used to be a nice white neighborhood, basically, you know, and I was like, oh my God.
Yeah. Well, if these were 1 million French people, this wouldn't really matter.
I hear you. Yeah.
And it's something which we talked about just before we actually started to record. And it's what I call this kind of theory of cultural concentric circles. So you take a country, And let's say a Western European country, and generally it kind of goes like this, that there are the core countries immediately around you, and you are fine with those. So nobody sees, you know, I think there's something like 3 million people that can hold an Irish passport within the UK. Nobody sees them as immigrants. They're the Irish. We like the Irish. It's our next door neighbours. British people don't even see Ireland as a separate country. We've had open borders with Ireland ever since the Irish Republic was founded. The Irish are fine. Ditto the French. So you can go to London, you can go to South Kensington in London, which is an overwhelmingly French area, but people see it as cosmopolitan, chichi, and lovely. And you walk into a boulangerie and somebody's there speaking French and you are in London. That is fine. Ditto, in the 70s, there's all this talk of Swedish au pairs and then there were the Italian nannies in the 90s. That's fine, right? Culturally, these are people who the Brits line up against.
Yeah.
Line up with, sorry, not against.
Yeah.
So that is fine. The difference then comes when you start to then move out. So Austrians are fine. They're not a problem. Danes are fine. They're not a problem. We understand that's
growing pains. I mean, you get used to having kielbasses and pivo or whatever. Yeah. I mean,
But the issue then comes with countries of which you don't have this shared historical... Right. And let's call it antagonism. So, you know, the Germans and the Brits went at it for a few wars. But we said, you know what? We understand you. You are like us. Your economy's kind of like ours. You're as rich as us. You look like us. We understand the nuance. We understand a certain amount of the nuances of your culture. So you have this.
You go to the vacation on the same places.
Exactly, exactly. We play each other in football, you know, every 4 years. And as bad as things are, all we want to do is just beat you at football. So that's one concentric circle of cultural familiarity. Then you have the next concentric circle, which is the ex-communist countries who are, let's say, non-Balkan. So Poles, they're a little bit different. They've got funny script and whatever, but they kind of look like us. So that would be Poland, Czech Republic, Hungary, Slovakia, all the Baltic states, right? But then there's another concentric circle, and then this is where then people just start to draw a line. And I'm talking about specifically about the UK now, which is your Bulgarias and your Romanias.
France had big problems. If you remember, a couple of years ago, France was also saying, it was specifically about the Roma, I believe, saying that Romanians need to have a border, or like a passport control, or this or that kind of thing. Limit the movement of people. Just a couple of years ago, it was when I was still living in Prague.
Yeah.
But I was kind of surprised then. It was like, if it's the EU, you need to get over the growing pains. You let Bulgaria in and Romania. You just need to be okay with that now. You need to accept what that means.
There's this long-standing anti-Gypsy, if I'm allowed to use that word, anti-Gypsy bigotry that has been a long-standing thing in Europe in general.
But when they brought in Romania and Bulgaria, maybe they didn't think about it. Maybe, I don't know what. But then they're suddenly like, oh, we have a significant Roma population, Gypsy population of people. I don't know. It's offensive, that term.
It's significant. As somebody who is of color, who sees himself as English and British, the last bastion of, let's say, polite out and out racism in Britain is actually Roma. So nobody,
not just Britain.
Well,
blew my mind. When I was an English teacher, to interrupt.
Go, Travis.
Well, I was just gonna quick anecdote that they would say, we don't hate other people, we don't hate this or that, we're not anti-Semitic anymore, except for Gypsies, of course. And I was just like, what? And they're like, yeah, I mean, they just don't want to be part of society, and they're this and that. And I was like, whoa, and they're discriminated against to this day, like all the way up and down school system to the labor force. It's that's an issue. Mm-hmm.
You get down a pretty deep rabbit hole with that, but
but that does come down. That's part of this is, so Czechs also did not accept the currency. Mm. They still have the Czech crown.
But this rise
of nationalism, there's the check out movement. You guys have Brexit. There's the check out. That's next. They're just right in the middle of Euro countries. It can't happen, but there's a movement to leave for sure.
But let's try and understand the reason for this movement to leave, which is Britain's move to say that it wants to exit. Is that going to cause contagion, number one? And maybe you can answer that, Ben. But then number two, and let's switch it the other way around. Number one, why is it that there are certain elements of the population in Britain and then possibly in Europe that are anti the free movement of labour? What has it done to their communities? And then number two, is there a potential for contagion in, let's say, Holland, in Sweden, in France with the Front National, for example, that we could see other referendum to pull their countries out of the EU? Ben, what do you think?
So as to the why of being opposed to free movement, I'm, there's some pretty basic human reactions to just being afraid of other people who aren't familiar, who don't have, a shared experience. And that actually gets to the basis of what a nation is, because, we feel this connection to, other people, for me, other people who are from the United States or whatever. But it's based on nothing. I don't know them from Adam. There's a lot of people here. And most of them I probably don't like. The whole nation thing is built on a shared set of myths and legends and culture and things like that. And having someone who doesn't share that same set of values necessarily makes it so you have to work a little bit harder to communicate properly. And most people don't have the patience for that. And I think, you know, react with anger a lot of the times.
Yeah, I think you have to mention hand in hand with fear is in many, many, many cases, a lack of education. It's just a very simple, it's the people that haven't, you're not going to, so I've come across dozens of Brits in Prague as expats, and not a single one of them voted, according to my Facebook page, when it happened, not a single one of them voted Brexit. They were all Remainers. And that's just, you know, the people that travel, the people that leave, expats, they're not going to be, you know, they're not going to think like that. They're not going to vote that certain way. So fear and then lack of education, you know.
But I think we do a disservice to
kind of a lot of people. That needs to be said also. Yeah, yeah. I know.
You know, we my mother. So my immigrant mother, who's been in the United Kingdom for 50 odd years, 54 years, something like that. She voted to leave. And we had words.
What was her reason?
Yeah. I'm going to come on to her reasons. We had words, to put it mildly. Now, number one, she said that she was voting because there were too many immigrants, people coming over to the United Kingdom, and they don't. And she basically said what you said, Ben. She said they don't share our values. Okay. She said they don't work as hard, they want benefits, etc. Now, any economist will tell you that in terms of working hard, immigrants work harder than the host population wherever they go. They take the crappiest jobs. They take jobs which the host population doesn't want to do. And they absolutely work harder. Yeah. And they're a net economic positive. Absolutely, mm-hmm. they are. And specifically in the United Kingdom, as an example, our National Health Service would literally collapse. If you were to, and no one's saying this, even the most rabid leaver is not saying this, but if you were to say to all the Poles, all the Bulgarians, all the whoever's, who are working in the National Health Service, you know, you leave tomorrow, the thing would collapse. So they're an absolute bedrock into the UK economic and labour force. Absolute, you know. So the whole thing would just collapse around its ears. But there is a perception that these people are taking jobs. There is a perception.
Yeah.
Which has been fed to certain people by a right-wing press, that these people are different. They don't want to integrate. And it's ironic in the extreme that here is an immigrant whose skin colour marks her out as being a British person, but with a short tale of a history to explain the reason why she's there. Because my mother can't pass for somebody who is British through and through. She can't. She's a hyphenated Brit. Okay?
Right.
That she does not equate herself and the way that she was perceived when she first came to Britain in the 1960s with the way that the Poles are or the Bulgarians.
Yeah.
And
shouldn't she have memories of, you know, discrimination?
She because she sees that these people don't share our values. Though I was horrified, to put it mildly, when my mother told me that she voted to leave, my dad voted to stay. So, you know, that literally 50-50 British split is manifest in my parents' household.
Right through the household. Right. Ouch, yeah.
But what a lot of older people from the Commonwealth would say is that, yes, but we're Commonwealth people. We kind of understand Britain. When my father came here, Jamaica was still a colony of the British Empire, and they still had pounds, shillings and pence in Jamaica. You know, the Queen is still the Queen of Jamaica. She's not only just the Queen of the United Kingdom and the Queen of Canada, she's and Australia, she's the Queen of Jamaica. So there are cultural ties that those people feel towards the United Kingdom, which I'm be quite honest about it, that some older people in the United Kingdom do not feel towards them. You know, they don't.
Right.
But those, but that generation does feel that towards the United Kingdom.
Yeah. So maybe your mother would be okay with anybody from the Commonwealth, no matter what part of the Commonwealth they're from.
She'd be more
somebody from Eastern Europe.
She'd be more right about it. But it gets to my talking about people of Black and Asian descent who voted Leave could well be a bit of a fundamental misnomer. I don't think it is in Birmingham, in my hometown, because there's a large part of the population of Birmingham which is non-white. And Birmingham voted just 50. Like, Birmingham is going to be, if not the first, the second UK city where white folks are in the minority. So that tells you how big the immigrant population is in Birmingham, or the non-white population is of Birmingham. And it voted just 50%, 51%, 51.1% to leave. So that's a lot of people with brown skin and black skin voting to leave. But at the core of this anger against the EU in Britain, and I think it has a mirror in US and other in US politics, is the angry white working class person who feels disenfranchised. And this has got really, this isn't the fault of the EU, this is globalization. So you have northern cities or northern towns, which are historically bastions of the Labour Party. That's the left-leaning political party within the UK. And these cities are post-industrial. So what London has managed to do is throughout the 1960s and the 70s, London had docks. London had great swathes of manufacturing textiles. Where in Eastern London, in East London, which is where in the 1930s there was massive waves of Jewish emigration. But then Oswald Mosley fought with Jews and with socialists and with communists in Shoreditch. You had a massive textile industry there. Up until quite recently, you had the docks in Canary Wharf which is Docklands. You had whole swathes of industry which were based in London, manufacturing industry. You don't have that anymore. London has successfully transitioned itself in the last 30 years into a successful post-industrial unit.
Mm-hmm.
That has not happened as successfully in my hometown of Birmingham. It's not been unsuccessful.
Yeah.
But it's happened more successfully in Manchester, but it hasn't happened in places like Bolton, in Preston, in Bradford, these northern cities which were the workhorse actually of the British Empire. And it's in those areas that the Leave vote has been stunning, because these communities have been victims of globalizations. You have these Lancaster mill towns, they're your Prestons and your Burnleys and whatever, that historically were all built on cotton. Those jobs are now misled, right?
I mean, because nothing's really going to change, even they're not going to change like the free market or the free trade agreements with the EU and everything that goes along with that.
But that is my point, though, is that
we've got their hope, at least, right?
Before we even get to this is the hope.
If I can jump in,
make my point. I know I'm somewhat kind of meandering here. We have to acknowledge that there are areas of the UK which are mirrored throughout Western Europe, which are relatively speaking blighted.
Mirrored in the States too. Yeah.
Yes, I know. You have Detroit. You have the Rust Belt in the Midwest.
Sure.
Absolutely. And that what globalization has done is taken away traditional jobs, which for generations were done in these areas, and nothing has come to replace it. And what people have been told is that free trade is a panacea of all. It's great, it's wonderful, it's smashing, it's super. Right. Look at the fact that in Williamsburg in New York, this hipster can just open up a coffee shop. Look at all this great software which is being developed in Silicon Valley. America is this great engine of technological change. You know, wow, look at London. It's this great cosmopolitan place where Russians hang out with Italians and they drive German cars. And all that is true. But that stuff, that urban renewal, that industrial economic growth isn't happening evenly. It's not happening in Cleveland. Yeah. It's not happening in Bolton. It's not happening in Lille in France, you know. And that is the reason why people are really voting against this new status quo. It just so happened that people were asked... People were told the EU is great for us all, and the EU has been a net benefit to the United Kingdom, but its benefits have not been evenly spread, and these towns have just felt neglected, they felt marginalised. My mother said, there are no jobs for my kids. I said, Mum, I'm fine, don't worry about me. And... you know, I am an example, though I'm in the United States, of somebody who believes in the free movement of labor. I've picked myself up. I'm now in the States.
Tell me about it. Yeah. I mean.
So I'm fine, right? But the perception is, in which 50% of Brits have this perception, and I'm sure if you're to scratch the surface of Germany, that, you know, there's a reason why there are far right parties which are on the rise in Eastern Germany, because all the same economic things are happening there in Leipzig. In Dresden. People are saying, wait on a minute, this shiny great future, it doesn't apply to me. Where is that job that I can do? You know, do an honest day's work without having to go to university or put myself through debt. What is that job that I can do? And then I can, you know, bring home money to bring up my family. And we've forgotten about those areas. We've forgotten about them. And this has come to bite us in the arse in the United Kingdom.
Where's cause and effect there? How is leaving the EU going to change that? How is electing Trump going to change that?
It makes it worse. But I believe that 20% of this vote was a protest vote. This was a referendum on Cameron, on the EU, on globalization, on frustration.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
So I think if they just did the referendum over again, they might be like, oh, whoa, and it might be like 70-30.
If the referendum vote happened today.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It would absolutely fail. People have realized very quickly, that this was completely the wrong move.
Okay, so now I got a question for you, because the referendum is not legally binding, actually.
No, it's not.
And so now people are reeling from the, oh, wait a minute, and people are quickly educating themselves and finding out that, oh, this, you know, it might not actually do anything positive at all. So they haven't, it's not like they have resigned from the EU by voting. This was just the
Article 50 needs to be invoked, and Article 50 hasn't, and that is the mechanism
whereby
a country actually exits. So it hasn't actually been invoked. But
so do you think there's a chance that they might just not? They might just replaces
you
Cameron,
heard it here first. The United Kingdom is not going to leave the European Union.
There you go.
Something like this is going to happen. This whole situation is evolving as we speak.
I'm so happy to hear that. I'm still kind of in shock. Like if I'm in denial, basically. I'm like, no, it can't actually happen. And I've been reading it, and like, they might postpone Article 50. But yeah, go ahead. What do you think is actually going
to
happen?
Something like this is going to happen. And as I kind of hinted at, just since we've been talking, things are moving at a rapid pace in the United Kingdom. So this referendum result doesn't bind Parliament actually to taking us out of the European Union. Though such a big song and dance has been made about the whole thing, that it would be a very brave Parliament, the way it's currently constructed, that turned round and actually said, screw you, British public. Okay?
Yeah.
So what we're actually having, and preceding the vote, there was massive Tory infighting. The Tories are the Conservative Party, which lines up with the Republicans in the US. So the whole reason for this vote was so that Cameron, the Prime Minister, could quell backbench dissent amongst MPs that wanted to have lesser engagement with the EU. And he thought, I'll have this referendum, it'll put that to bed so that I can clearly go on and do my business, because we are definitely part
of
the EU.
Same thing with Scottish independence. Was that the same idea?
Yes and no. But it wasn't a Tory infighting thing.
Partially. Okay.
So you got the Tory party that, from the time of Thatcher onwards, has been, at least 50% of it has been Eurosceptic. Has gone, these Germans and these French are talking about political union. God damn it, we're British. We don't want any part of that. We just want to sell stuff and buy stuff. Okay? So this Tory infighting has gone over onto Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So number one, Cameron has now stepped down because the Conservative Party's official title is the Conservative a Conservative and Unionist Party of the United Kingdom is its official title. You cannot be a Tory leader and basically preside over the disillusionment of the United Kingdom. And this was such a political gamble by Cameron that he's fallen on his sword straight away and said, okay, I need to go.
Yeah.
Right? But, and here is the interesting thing. So Boris Johnson, who's the Mayor of London, who has been a massive proponent for Leave, and it kind of shocked everybody that actually he was pro-Leave, and many people have seen his political opportunism by him. If you're the Mayor of London, London is one of the most diverse cities in the world, if arguably, mm-hmm. if actually isn't, why would you then turn round and then say within a month of leaving the mayorship of London that you are in effect anti-immigration? Because behind all this Leave stuff is protectionism, is smaller governance. Yes, that might be you might be able to do that and hold your head up economically and whatever, but you cannot be the Mayor of London and then also say, but actually we don't want a free movement of labour, because that's what London's success in the last 20 years has been built on. Like all the American bankers that are there, all the Germans, the Italians, the Russians, whatever.
And now Boris Johnson.
At the end of this campaign, I think you'll agree, there is a very clear choice between those on their side who speak of nothing but fear of the consequences of leaving the EU, and we on our side who offer hope. Between those who have been endlessly rubbishing our country and running it down, and those of us who believe in Britain. They say we can't do it. We say we can. They say we have no choice but to bow down to Brussels. We say they are woefully underestimating this country and what it can do. If we vote leave, we can take back control of our borders, of huge sums of money, £10 billion a year net, of our tax-raising powers, of our trade policy, and of our whole law-making system, the democracy that is the foundation of our prosperity. And if we stand up for democracy, we will be speaking up for hundreds of millions of people around Europe who agree with us but who currently have no voice. And if we vote leave and take back control, I believe that this Thursday can be our country's Independence Day.
So there is now a move within the Tory party, because everybody, because he is the heir assumptive in terms of leading the Tory party, which means he'll be the next British Prime Minister, that there is such anger with the Remain Tories that people are trying to block him from automatically becoming the leader of the Tory party. Interestingly, though, the Labour Party, so this is another pro-Remain party, because all these working class areas voted to leave, that the new leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, who's quite left, is as left as Bernie Sanders is in the States, that there's a vote of no confidence is going to be tabled by the Parliamentary Labour Party, I believe on Tuesday, but already half of his shadow cabinet have actually resigned. So since I've woken up, I think 6-7 senior Labour MPs have resigned, basically saying that we are resigning because we do not believe that Jeremy Corbyn tried hard enough in this Remain campaign, but that there is going to be a second general election very soon, and we need someone who can excite the Labour base in those northern mill towns, but also recognises the fact that these people feel disenfranchised. So the political calculus in the United Kingdom at the moment is this, is that David Cameron is gone, he's toast. The Tories are going to go in for a round of infighting. The Labour Party are doing it already. Politicians and the political establishment class do not want to leave the European Union. I think what will happen is that there will be a second general election, because if somebody was to, you know, there is no way that this parliament, is the way it's constructed, can actually sign bills to leave the European Union, because most MPs, overwhelming majority of MPs, 80%, 70%, want to remain. So they can't do it in all good consciousness. So there will, a new general election will be called, maybe after the new prime minister comes in power, because he will start the formal mechanism to leave, and those bills will just not pass. They will not pass. Mm-hmm. Then there'll be a general election of which various MPs will say things like, I want to remain, whether they're Tory or Labour will not matter. And already the Liberal Democrats have said, we will fight the next general election saying that we want to remain within the EU. So you will have MPs of all three major parties saying, if you vote for me, I'm going to remain. So then you'll have a parliament, you'll have a parliament returned, which overwhelmingly MPs will want to remain. These are possible that, you know, you'll have maybe more, slightly more MPs that will want to leave, but still those remain MPs will be in the majority. They'll call a second referendum within a year. And it will be voted down. This has happened in Ireland. Ireland had a similar thing, I forget, 10, 15 years ago. And I forget exactly what they were voting on. But they had one referendum which went against what the Irish government wanted. And in a year, they had another one. And then they got what they wanted and says, okay, that's the result we wanted. We're fine.
That's the good one. Yeah.
That was on the Lisbon Treaty.
There you go. There you go. So yeah, there is precedent for this. It's just that, you know, for Ireland to dither is one thing, but for the United Kingdom, which is one of the main planks economically of the European Union, you know, the second biggest in terms of population, the second biggest in terms of economic size, etc., you know, the ramifications are massive geopolitically. But I'm telling you right here and now, the United Kingdom, or at least let's call it in the safest way, England and Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland will still be in the European Union in 10 years' time. Whether it's called the United Kingdom, I don't know.
Now, wait a minute. So first of all, I think I agree with that prediction. Like it's also kind of an optimistic prediction, but it's the one that I, at the moment, I just have to believe. I mean, it's just crazy to, I'm in denial about them actually leaving, but tell us what would happen if they actually leave. What does that mean? So let's say, you know, they invoke Article 50, they're out of the EU. What's next?
Okay, so immediately,
Scotland and Northern Ireland.
Well, I don't know about Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland's a funny case, and I'll come on to Northern Ireland in a little bit. Scotland is gone. Whether it takes 1 year, 18 months, 3 years, there will be a referendum in Scotland and Scotland will vote to leave the United Kingdom.
And join the EU.
Yes.
Yeah.
Full stop. You know, that's just absolute stone cold fact. However, Northern Ireland is a funny one. Now, what a lot of people didn't understand or don't understand about the EU is that Norway has this weird association with the EU, that Norway, to all intents and purposes, is part of the EU but isn't. So it has no part in any of the governance of it, but signs up to all the laws, the single market, free movement of trade and of labour. And it pays for this. Mm-hmm. So even the most rabid leaver admits that really Britain would have Norway status. So that actually means that all these people in Northern Ireland that are running off and trying to get Irish passports needn't do that, because we are still going to have free movement of labour.
Which doesn't that defeat the whole campaign, the whole rhetoric?
Exactly. So the most rabid person that wants to leave even they will go, well, okay, but we're still going to have those nice Germans coming into London and working in merchant banking companies. We're still going to be able to buy German cars without a massive tariff. We're still going to... Yeah, so what this is more of a philosophical, political idea of governance and of control, that we are seen to be not giving up any of our political sovereignty, but economically, that we are, we are, and we're actually quite happy to do that. And people who understand global trade understand that you need to be part of robust trading blocks. They get that, but it's the poor, relatively poor person in Bolton, in Burnley, in Wolverhampton, who comes out of school without great academic prospects. 50 years ago, they could have just walked into an apprenticeship and got themselves a decent job. You know, they say, well, this has got still got nothing to do with me. But anyway, I'm going on to a point which I kind of made before. Well, Northern
they,
Ireland.
Maybe they don't realize now they can go get a scholarship in Bucharest, you know, get a job offer at an English, at an American or English, in any case, English speaking company, you know, in Paris or Berlin or Rome or anywhere they want, Madrid, and then come back and retire in the UK when they're older. But I think people are people just not that mobile? Like,
well, but you know what? That's a really good point. People are not that mobile in smaller towns throughout the world.
Because it opens up opportunities for everyone.
But it's people are much more mobile in bigger cities because they see people who are different and from other places, and they realize, well, if they've come here, I can kind of go somewhere else, somewhere too. So it's these towns, it's these communities which are much more settled historically that have voted against immigration. And the joke is that they're the most homogeneous places. Not all of them, but a lot of them. You know, the irony is that the places that have said, oh, yeah, we're kind of pro-open borders and immigration are the most diverse places.
Yeah. So,
but anyway, Northern Ireland. I mean, Northern Ireland. Let's quickly just go on to Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland is a strange situation in lots of ways in the United Kingdom. Number one, the main United Kingdom parties, the Lib Dems, the Labour Party, the Conservative Party, do not stand in the Stormont Parliament for historic reasons, that they just don't campaign there. So you don't have a Tory party in Northern Ireland, you don't have a Labour Party, etc., etc. They have their own political parties over there, which line up nakedly on sectarian grounds. Now, I forget exactly what the current census would say, but it's going to be something like 55% of the population of Northern Ireland is Protestant. I could be wrong by a few degrees, but I don't think it's 60-40. I think it's more 55-45. And what that means is that the Protestants want to remain part of the United Kingdom. It was those Protestants that fought back at the formation of the Irish Free State for Ulster to remain part of the EU. Okay,
that still matters. Like,
no, it still matters. It still matters.
The still Good Friday matters. Agreements are not that old.
Yeah, and no. I know. They're like twenty years maybe. So yes, there is no major terrorism at all in Northern Ireland, but you have a Protestant.
But they still
rump.
Vote along.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. You have a Protestant rump, whether it's the DUP or the official Unionist Party. That vote on sectarian grounds. And the majority of people in Northern Ireland want to be part of the EU. I'm sorry, of the United Kingdom, full stop. The Irish state, and I forget what article it is of the Irish state, but it might be Article 1, Article 2, I can't remember, but very clearly says in its constitution that anybody born in the island of Ireland can claim an Irish passport. So that is the reason why you've had this relative run on Irish people applying for Irish passports in Northern Ireland, because they can in effect still remain part of the EU. Don't worry, guys. Even if we leave, you're still going to be able to have free movement. You know, free movement within the European Union.
I even thought about getting a German passport or even going for Czech citizenship just to make the paperwork that much easier. Like, I get it. If you can have another passport, there's no real harm in it, I guess. If anything, it makes countries more interdependent. Having all these multinational, like, you know, people with multiple citizens.
Yeah, but what you're saying there, Trevor, is somewhat anathema to those people in those more settled post-industrial blighted communities, though. You know, they're like, you know, we need jobs, we need opportunities right here and now. But just to get on, just to finish up with Northern Ireland, that the province of Northern Ireland is a massive economic drain on the British state, because we have a military and security apparatus to maintain there. It's much less than it used to be in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s when there were physically British troops walking down the streets of Belfast. But still, it's a relatively poor region in British terms. Relatively poor. It's not a basket case, don't get me wrong, but it's relatively poor. And it survives partly, or in large part, sorry, on subsidies from the UK government. And the Irish state, it would be a massive undertaking for the Irish state actually to take on Northern Ireland, you know, to take on all of its pensions, benefits, obligations, etc.
Right, yeah,
and could only do that with massive EU help, because there's only, and again, I'm not Googling this, but the population of Ireland is only something like the Irish state, something like 5 million.
But the
5.5.
EU, yeah, but I mean, it is possible.
Economically, if it could be done, and the EU would have to massively go in and help the Irish state. But then you're going to have sectarian violence. You're going to have these Protestants going, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, the Ulster Defence Force, you know, you're going to have the potential for sectarian violence. There would have to be some associate status for Northern Ireland within a loose association of the Irish state, which would have to be underpinned by EU governance. Because otherwise, Protestants are not going to go for it. They're just going to say, but we've just fought since 1920s to have a Protestant ascendancy in Ulster. And, you know, we do not want to be part of a united Ireland. It'd be constitutionally, I'm not saying it's impossible, but constitutionally, people have to do backflips all over the place.
I agree and I disagree, though, because part of the reason the Good Friday agreements have held is that whole Celtic tiger thing. For most of the last 40 years, 30 years, the Irish economy has been doing gangbusters. And if it's not doing it right now, that doesn't mean that that's a permanent status. And a lot of the stability in Northern Ireland over the last couple years has been due to economic activity that's been going across the border, and due to at least some of the Protestants in Northern Ireland going, well, you know, in Belfast and most of Northern Ireland is as much a economic basket case as Northern England and all those towns that you were talking about. And it's a Rust Belt city in American terms. And it's been, and that wasn't helped by the fact that there was a massive civil war going on. And it's been what economic activity exists in Belfast and in the North in general has been due to tourism from, people coming up from the South. And then, with investment from London, there has been sort of a post-industrial pickup to a certain extent, and a lot of that's due to being in the EU, which is why they voted so overwhelmingly to remain, and to at least some of the people, regardless of religion in Northern Ireland, this vote has to look like, from their perspective, England just threw them under the bus economically. Yeah. I don't disagree, though, that it would be a tear for the.
I was reading an article. Maybe there's parallels here with Northern Ireland. I was reading an article about Cornwall, where they just kind of realized,
funny.
Like, wait a minute. A lot of the subsidies came from the EU directly because they're kind of a poorer place. And then they're kind of like asking themselves, like, now, wait a minute. Is London going to pick up the tab of these millions of pounds a year, you know, that came in every year?
Their big economic asset was ferry ports going to Brittany.
Yeah. So, whoops. Oh, because that's going to be a tertiary border crossing now.
I guarantee you it won't be, but and I think I kind of said this way back when about my whole kind of theory of these kind of concentric cultural circles, but there hasn't been, even at the height of the troubles in Northern Ireland, yes, there were border crossings, but you didn't need to show your passport per se, you know, so there was actually free movement of people before you know, the Lisbon Treaty or whatever between the United Kingdom and Ireland. And actually Ireland has had this special status within the UK whereby ever since the foundation of the Irish Free State, you as an Irish person could come and just live in the UK. So in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, you could just come and pick yourself up, move to the UK, and you were treated as being a British citizen and could vote in British elections straight away. You were not seen technically as being a foreigner, even though Ireland wasn't part of the Commonwealth when it got independent and obviously left the British Empire. My parents came when there was that still same movement for people from the British Empire, but those barriers were then put up in the 60s and the 70s. So by, let's say, the 1970s, if you were Jamaican or Indian or Pakistani, you then had to apply to come to the United Kingdom and go through immigration and have a visa, etc. That's never happened with Ireland and won't. So whatever happens, that border between Ulster and the Irish Republic will be just be something
independent
on a piece
of
paper.
Else that happens.
That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. So
it is interesting, though. I do think that the I agree. And I do think that the Ulstermen aren't going to, or the Orangists aren't going to leave the UK. They aren't going to be okay with joining the Irish Free State straight off. But they also have more of a cultural affinity with Scotland than England, per se. Most of them are Presbyterian, and as opposed to Anglican. So if Scotland left the UK, it might be interesting to see what happened. We might be talking about like a 40-year process, but anyway, this is all very wild speculation.
Somewhat strange for us lovers of history to be wildly speculating. Normally, we like to look backwards.
I'm just thinking we're
going
to have a part two in a couple of years here. We're going to have to reconvene. Listen to the old episode and then be like, okay, here's what we got right, here's what we got wrong, and boy, did we not see this coming.
Yeah.
Like, who knew?
There are going to be many twists and turns before the end of the next week before we get on to the end of the year with this. But just to wrap up, gentlemen, what now for Europe? Is the European dream over?
So much of that depends on the next few weeks and the next few months and the parliament that gets elected, like you've been saying.
I'm just so optimistic that not really anything's going to effectively change. I mean, I would say if anything, now's a great time to invest in the market because it's all going to bounce back and everything's going to be fine. Keep calm and carry on.
Right. That said, I mean, there are these Eurosceptic parties across Europe that have been upset at things. And it should be said that there's some economic aspects of the EU that are worth complaining about beyond not the immigration stuff. There's it does have kind of a bloated bureaucracy and things like that. You know, and there's these cultural divides beyond the English Channel that, you know, Northern and Western Europe themselves look down on Southern and Eastern Europe. And there's some pretty big aspects of that. But as we've said earlier, I think one of the big issues is going to be the relationship between France and Germany. And there's a whole lot of question marks there, because I don't think either country really knows where they're going to be in 5 years.
Yeah. Question marks again now. I mean, yeah, all these nationalistic movements in France and Germany. Germany, I hope it's still, they're not going to have any kind of real power in parliament, but they're still on the rise. That's the scary part.
Merkel has a pretty good grasp on the reins right now, so Germany's maybe a little bit more stable, but
it's France, more stable, I'd say. But yeah, France, jeez, what is happening?
I don't think we have to worry too much about the fate of the European Union just yet. If it gets reduced by one member state, it'll be, you know, that will be just about it. The European Union still has a future. Whether the United Kingdom has one, I'm still quite bullish about it, but I freely admit that I am an eternal optimist. Gentlemen, it's been great speaking to you today. I've been joined by Ben Jacobs over there in the good US of A, and also by Travis Dow, who is sat in Santa Clara. I've been Royfield Brown, sat in a very sunny East Bay in California also. God bless the United Kingdom. Let's not screw it up, guys. There you go.
God save the Queen, awesome. but within the EU, please. Thanks.
The Agora Podcast Network. Agora is a marketplace of the mind, where intelligent, independent podcasts meet curious and discerning listeners. Our network of shows includes
American Biography,
The Bohemian Podcast,
How Jamaica Conquered the World,
The History of the Papacy,
The History of England,
The History of Alchemy Podcast,
Mid-Atlantic,
When Diplomacy Fails,
1001.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Conversations.
History of Anglo-Saxon England.
The Secret Cabinet from Germany.
10 American Presidents.
The History of Germany podcast.
The Agora Podcast Network.com. Listen to Agora today.